Everyone, I'm Michael Jordan with the Bitcoin Way podcast. I appreciate you being here. Today, I am joined by Andrew Howard, the Chief Business Officer at Jan3. Jan3 is doing some awesome things, particularly around nation-state adoption of Bitcoin, and had a great conversation with Andrew. He has a wealth of knowledge on the subject of Bitcoin. He spent time on active duty as a recon Marine back in 2017, and today he helps people from all over the world understand and invest in Bitcoin, from everyday investors to high net worth individuals, family offices, and companies. And again, this guy knows his stuff. We spent pretty much the entire episode debunking a lot of the most common Bitcoin FUD. So any question or objection that your grandma, best friend, financial advisor, cousin has ever thrown at you, I think we're going to at least touch on it. And my hope is that this episode would be a resource for you to pass along to them to maybe get them a better understanding, a more foundational understanding of why Bitcoin does have viability, durability, and value in this world, and why so many of us are excited about the things it's going to do. Again, Andrew was awesome. This was my first podcast episode, so I couldn't have asked for a better person to join me and share some of his knowledge about the subject. I hope you enjoy the episode. All righty, everyone. Like I said in the intro, I've got Andrew Howard here with me. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. Thanks for having me on. This is podcast number one, I believe, so that's exciting.
Number one. So hopefully I don't mess it up. I'm looking forward to a good conversation. And my hope is that we've picked a good theme here. Debunking Bitcoin FUD. It's everyone who isn't a Bitcoiner. And I mean, you know, rightfully Bitcoiners too, but everyone's got their questions about Bitcoin. Some of them more reasonable than others, some of them easier to debunk, but I'm looking forward to getting into it with you. It sounds like you've had a lot of these conversations and might be the chief debunker. So before we jump into that, though, I would love to hear just even briefly your Bitcoin journey, how you were orange-pilled, how you came to Bitcoin before we get to any of that.
Yeah, so Bitcoin journey actually first began in 2017, mid-2017, luckily before the huge bull run back then. And I was active duty Marine Corps stationed in Camp Pendleton, San Diego, California. And so I've been always been super patriotic. Almost every man in my family served in the military. So that was kind of the natural progression of of events for me after I graduated high school. And I started reading about different things like how the Federal Reserve was created. I read the book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, which is one of the best books I think anybody could possibly read. Talks about how central banking works, what even is money, the history of gold being money. And so it's a really interesting question, right? Because we're not really taught about what money even is in school. We just know that it has value and it's something you use and it's just this ubiquitous thing you don't really put a lot of thought into. And in that course of events, I learned about Bitcoin and that changed a lot for me. When I first learned about it, I was extremely intrigued by the potential it had to offer. The idea of the internet itself having a native currency, which no one group can monopolize and control, which can be sent anywhere in the world in a matter of seconds for quite cheap. And so just the technology of it and also the philosophical aspect of it was pretty interesting. And so fast forward, I got out of the Marines and, you know, worked a few different jobs. And now currently my role is chief business officer at a company called Jan3. And I can just get into what Jan3 is if you'd like.
I'd love to hear a bit about it. What mission you all are on?
Yeah. So what we are most known for is nation state Bitcoin adoption. So especially our CEO, Samson Mao, is a very public guy. He's been in the Bitcoin space for a very long time. We offer Bitcoin effectively consulting on Bitcoin policy. So 2 months ago, our CEO had a meeting with the president of Colombia about Bitcoin. In the same week, he also met with the president of Suriname, which is a very small Latin American country of 600,000 people, I believe is their population. Excuse me. So, I mean, a lot of other politicians too. He spoken with senators in Mexico, some parliament members in Europe. So the list goes on and on. But so that's the most well known part of the company. Second aspect of the company is Aqua Wallet, which I'm wearing right now. It's a really easy to use Bitcoin wallet. Maybe some of your viewers don't know what this means yet, but it's a non-custodial open source wallet, which is exactly the kind of wallet you want to use if you want the most amount of freedom possible using Bitcoin. And third aspect of the company is Jan3 Financial. So that's where it's a service where we help high net worth individuals, family offices, institutions, and eventually nation states acquire large amounts of Bitcoin via over the counter. So that, you know, I've had a lot of interesting experiences. I've talked with billionaires who have bought Bitcoin. I've talked with CEOs of well-known corporations who are Bitcoin advocates. I've talked with people in politics who are Bitcoin advocates. And this thing is definitely not going away. I think there's a lot of confusion about it. There's also about 20,000, literally speaking, about 20,000 other cryptocurrencies. So there's confusion there too. Something like this, it's too impactful to just go away. And I think most of society has not yet realized how profound this new technology is.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So love the overview. And I mean, Jan3 is doing some awesome work. I'm just real curious, how is the reception at the nation state level? So especially when you're talking like at the higher levels of leadership of some of these places, is, are they generally understanding? Are they, could you kind of give me a sense as to how those conversations go or how quickly you sort of get them to recognize the value of this technology?
It ultimately depends on who we're speaking with. I actually can't say specifics because of NDAs. Sure. And privacy and all that with ongoing projects that are being worked through right now, but some more than others. You know, it really depends, because what does somebody in politics want? They want higher tax revenue, right? I mean, that's that's what you want. I think any logically thinking politician would want more business in their area. They want safety. They want to create jobs. And so banning a new technology is a horrible way to achieve all of those things.
Right.
You know,
I think I heard you on another podcast, you compared it to banning the internet back in the late 90s, early 2000s.
Yeah. Imagine how much less advanced and successful the United States would be if we banned the internet in the 90s. I mean, and really it was created in the 70s, but it became ubiquitous in the 90s and early 2000s. And so we're the United States, other than a few other countries, but really the United States is the tech capital of the world for tech companies. And so that's because we embraced a new technology. So I view the same thing happening with Bitcoin. I would say it's probably harder for people in politics to grasp it, because they can see it as competing against their national currency, which could seem like a threat to them. But as an American, you know, I care about America more than any other country. I'm American, and I have no shame saying that. And I want my country to adopt Bitcoin. I consider myself a patriot. I love the Constitution. I was raised with, you know, believing in American values, and I think Bitcoin is very in line with helping the United States becoming more peaceful, more prosperous. And I think it's the same with any other nation as well.
Yeah, no, completely agree. It's like I've heard said many times, the Bitcoin is more American than the US dollar. And it's not even close.
It absolutely is. And if you look at the Constitution of the United States, you can read Article 1, Section 10, and it says that money needs to be basically, it says money needs to be backed by gold or silver. And we don't have that anymore. Ever since 1971, the dollar has not been backed off of gold. A lot of people don't know that because, again, we're not taught about what money even is in school. But a lot of people don't know that since 1971, the U.S. dollar has been backed by absolutely nothing. It used to be backed by gold. For the majority of America's history, you could walk in a bank, you could take a dollar, you could take $20, give it to the bank, and then you can walk out with an ounce of gold. That's the way it worked, because 20 US dollars were equivalent to 1 ounce of gold for a very long time in the United States. And what happened then? We had probably the fastest amount of wealth creation in all of human history. You know, we had so many new forms of technology created. Society was doing very well. And it makes sense, because when your money is worth something, when you can save in your money and plan for your future, you have a lot more time to focus on other things like creating new technologies, like spending time with your family. And so I think we have a lot of societal problems today. We have a moral decay. We have people having less kids. I think in my generation, the millennial generation, there is a general lack of hope for the future. And I think it's very much so related with the money. We see our parents, you know, you could have maybe one parent working. Your dad would work, your mom would stay at home. They had three kids, they owned a car, they owned a house. Things were a lot different. So, and that's because of the money.
Yeah. I think a lot of people would recognize and appreciate some of the issues that you've identified. I think what's harder for many folks is to tie it back to the money. And that's what I think as Bitcoiners we're really trying to accomplish, and you, what you all are trying to do at the nation state level. So last question before we jump right into the FUD, and a lot of that will be rapid fire, probably a little less conversational, but I'll chime in where I, you know, feel like maybe I could contribute. How would you describe, if someone just says, what is Bitcoin? That's the question. Briefly, how would you try to frame that? Friend, family member, you know, someone like that just wants to understand, what is Bitcoin?
Yeah, so that's probably the toughest question that I'll be asked today, because it's such a hard thing to describe concisely. Yes. But my typical answer is Bitcoin is, first of all, it's the native currency of the internet, which people have been talking about for a really long time, for like 40 years. There have been extremely smart people with IQs way higher than both of us that are cryptographers, and they've been entertaining this idea of, hey, what if the internet had a native currency where you could send it to anybody in the world, right? So that's what Bitcoin is. Additionally, Bitcoin is the separation between money and state, okay? And as a result, it is, I believe, proven to be the most advanced form of savings technology on the planet that we have today. Now, what do I mean the separation of money and state? Well, if you look at the separation of church and state back in the 1500s, most people could not fathom the idea of church and state being two separate entities. It was something, I mean, that was just the way they lived their lives. And the separation of church and state vastly changed how human beings interact with each other and how the earth works. And so this is the same concept with the separation of money and state. It's almost like, you know, one example I use is, let's say there was only one company where you could buy cars from. There's only one company that made the cars, that sold the cars. They had a total monopoly on cars. What would you have? You would have probably low quality cars. You'd have horrible customer service. They wouldn't last a long time. And it would make sense, because what incentive would that car company have to produce a better product if they have nobody competing against them and potentially putting them out of business? And so this is the same state with money today. For pretty much all of human history, we have not had money and state be two separate things. The state has had a monopoly on money. Does that make me some kind of, you know, anti-government crazy extremist? No, I just like the separation of church and state, I think things would work better if people had the freedom to choose what kind of money they want to use. And I think you would bring more accountability to government, which we desperately need today. And so that's what Bitcoin is. And if you look at the dollar today, we are being extremely irresponsible with it. We're, I believe, $34 trillion in debt right now in the United States. I sent over $100 billion to Ukraine, sending a bunch of money to a bunch of different countries, spreading ourselves thin. And that's because we have gotten very comfortable with being able to just run ourselves in more debt and have more U.S. dollars created so we can send it to, foreign interests overseas or wasteful government programs domestically. And it's just not sustainable. And so anyways, I don't want to rant too much, but that is how I would describe what Bitcoin is from a high level.
Yeah, I like that. I think it's a question that can lend itself toward very philosophical answers, but I think you hit on something very tangible, and that's the separation of money and state. That, I think, is something that people can generally appreciate, because you're right. If the government was the only producer of cars or the only ones who could innovate around technology, and you look at where government has interceded or on, research and things like that, the quality's deteriorated tremendously, And so I think it's something that people can recognize is probably suboptimal. What the leap that then needs to happen, I think, for a lot of people is it's not just suboptimal. I mean, it's quite literally the cause of so many of these problems that you've described in, previously. So Love that description of Bitcoin. You're right. That's the hardest question I could possibly ask you, because it is so many things to so many different people. So,
yep.
Let's jump into some FUD. We hear this in right-leaning, left-leaning publications, all over the news. Pick your senator, congressperson. Everyone has their own favorite edition of Bitcoin FUD. The one I'm going to start with is one we hear a lot, and that is Bitcoin is used for criminals. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, well, that's a big one that I think some politicians often use. Bitcoin is used for criminals. Well, my first response is, isn't the U.S. dollar also used by criminals as well? The U.S. dollar is used by criminals significantly more than Bitcoin is. And even institutions like J.P. Morgan, largest bank in the United States, was fined $290 million last year for laundering funds from Jeffrey Epstein. With U.S. dollars. So U.S. dollars are used by criminals as well. And this is a broader concern, because the thing is not the problem. If I were talking with somebody who's more right-leaning, who believes in the Constitution and American values, I would say it's the equivalent of saying that guns don't kill people, people kill people, which I believe is 100% true. It is physically impossible for a gun to kill someone. There has to be a human being behind it, using it for nefarious purposes. So aside from that, Bitcoin is used by criminals. It's also helped a lot of people in life. Bitcoin has been a tremendous, you could call it an investment or a savings tool. But to say that it's solely used by criminals and people are not using it to better their lives and save and plan for their futures is very myopic. There have been other studies done too, without getting too technical, that do on-chain analytics of Bitcoin and how transactions are being sent. And they've found that it's somewhere between less than 0.1% of all Bitcoin are used for money laundering activity. So the numbers show that it is extremely low, the amount of Bitcoin being used for criminal activity.
Yeah. And I'd add to that too. I think a lot of times what we need to do in the West, the United States probably specifically as holders of the global reserve currency, is really zoom out and understand that maybe you don't have a particular use case today for it if you don't understand or care for it as a savings technology. But that doesn't mean that there aren't billions of people around the world who are living in through war, hyperinflationary environments, you name it. I mean, so many circumstances. Absolutely. where an immutable, censorship resistant monetary tool is of immense value. So
I'll respond to that real quick. I have a friend from Venezuela who lived there right at the worst possible time, which was, I think, 6 years ago, and horrible hyperinflation, just crime everywhere. And his wife and his newborn baby of 3 months were just stuck there. And he's told me that there's no way he could have left Venezuela if it weren't for Bitcoin. You know, if he had his money in a bank account, that would have been seized. It would have been hyperinflated. All his hard earned money would have lost its value. But he had this form of money that could not be censored, that didn't lose its value, actually gained its value during that time, and could take his wife and his baby to a better country and have a better life because of Bitcoin. And there are a lot of cases of that.
Yep. Alrighty, Bitcoin is too volatile. I hear this one a lot too. Anyone in the world of finance you talk to, this is one of the big ones.
Yeah. So Bitcoin is too volatile. I wish I could pull up I have an article I wrote. I don't know if you can edit this out or what, but
no, we can figure it out.
Okay.
If you want to try sharing your screen or. Or we can put in the show notes too.
Yeah, hang on. Okay, here we go. I've got the article. So Bitcoin is too volatile. Yes, this is something you'll hear a lot. Bitcoin is too volatile. It was almost $70,000, and then it crashed down to $15,000. That's true. Yeah, the price is going up and down quite a lot, and it's not, quote, stable. But volatility can go both ways, and with Bitcoin, it's gone significantly higher than lower over a long enough time frame. So you'll see articles like, here's one. There's a Nobel Prize-winning economist, quote, named Paul Krugman. And he wrote an article back in 2013 saying that Bitcoin is evil. And the price at the time when he wrote the Bitcoin is Evil article in 2013 was $327. So yes, Bitcoin is very volatile, but historically speaking, the price has gone up and not down over a long enough mm-hmm. time frame. So you have other articles I'm looking at here too, which is here's one from 2014 posted on Reuters. Bitcoin's defects will hasten its demise. And at the time, that was $327. I'm looking at another one by another, quote, Nobel Prize winning economist. Robert Shiller is his name, written in 2014. The article is titled, Bitcoin is an amazing example of a bubble. And Bitcoin was $797 at the time. And right now, I believe, what are we at? 56,000, 55,000, something like that.
Yeah. Had a pump last night, I think, the time this is time of the recording.
Yeah. So I'll answer this with one last part. So I'll read a little timeline. If you think Bitcoin is volatile, again, keep in mind price is about, you know, it's well over $50,000, whatever it is currently. 2011, Bitcoin went up to $29, then crashed to $2.50. 2013, Bitcoin went up to $1,180, then crashed to $200 in 2015. In 2017, Bitcoin went up to $19,000, then crashed down to $3,200 in 2018. And in 2021, Bitcoin went up to $67,500. And then crashed to $15,000 in 2022. So here's the moral of the story is if you want to act like you're some genius trader who can look at charts and time things perfectly and buy low and sell high and good luck. But for me, I don't want to take that chance. I don't want to take any risk with that. I want to buy a long-term investment. And it's almost akin to buying property. When you buy, let's say, a rental property, you're going to hold it for 20 or 30 years. more. You're not going to buy a property and then sell it 3 months later. Some people do, they flip homes, but that's besides the point. And this is the same thing with Bitcoin. Everybody who's held this for a long enough time frame has had a profitable investment.
Yeah,
and actually, it's the best performing asset over the last decade. So it's not just a good, well-performing asset. It's the best performing asset over the last decade compared to any stocks.
Yep. Okay. What about, this is one where, you know, I think from a technical perspective, I don't know that I am equipped to dive so deep on this, but Bitcoin could be hacked, SHA-256, you know, the primary hashing algorithm used could be broken. What are the implications for Bitcoin if that were to happen?
Okay. So I'm going to pull up a tweet right now where I talk about this actually, and it's pretty interesting. So here we go. So SHA-256, first of all, what even is SHA-256? Actually, before I even explain what SHA-256 is, I need to say an important concept. I have no idea how my refrigerator works, but it works and I use it every day. And I don't need to know how it works in order to use it because it works. So I think this is the same thing with Bitcoin. It's just there are a lot more questions about what Bitcoin is, how does it work, because it's such an early thing. And there's a lot of hesitancy. So that's one concept to think in terms of. Now, SHA-256, it stands for Secure Hash Algorithm. This was released by the NSA, published by the NSA in 2001. This is the hash algorithm that secures Bitcoin. Okay, but it's not unique to Bitcoin. It's not just a Bitcoin thing. This is a form of cryptography which is used by tons of very legitimate, very well noted organizations. So I'll read some of these organizations. Government and military entities. So the U.S. Department of Defense, the National Security Agency, the FBI, the CIA, NASA, what else? The Federal Security Service, Russia, the Minister of Defense, United Kingdom. They all use SHA-256. Financial institutions and banking. J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, HSBC, Morgan Stanley, Wells Fargo, okay, technology companies and internet services, Google, Microsoft, Amazon, Facebook, Apple, Twitter, IBM, Intel, Cisco, Oracle, aerospace and defense contractors, Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, General Dynamics, energy and utility companies, ExxonMobil, Shell, BP, Chevron, Duke Energy, General Electric. Almost done. Telecommunications, AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, auto industry, Toyota, Volkswagen, General Motors, Ford Motor Company, BMW, Tesla, Honda Motor Company, retail and e-commerce, Walmart, Amazon, Target, eBay, Costco, Home Depot, Tesco, and then finally, academic and research institutions, MIT, Stanford, Harvard, Oxford, UC Berkeley, University College London. So if SHA-256 breaks, then we've got a lot of problems on our hands with a lot more than just Bitcoin. Well said. Yeah. Even if it did break, there's been FUD about, okay, well, quantum computing can break Bitcoin. There's a really good article written by his Twitter name is Armin the Parman. I believe it's titled "Can Quantum Computing Break Bitcoin?" Something like that. But worst comes to worst, we could do what's called the hard fork, and we could have a different hashing algorithm as well.
Right.
So it's not like the end of the world if SHA-256 breaks. It would be really bad for a lot of things, not just Bitcoin. But there are other options we could take if that happened.
Right. Alrighty, this is a good one. Bitcoin has no intrinsic value.
Yeah, so that's a very common one that you hear, particularly with people in older generations. They grew up in a physical world, right? Millennials grew up in a digital world. So Bitcoin has no intrinsic value. What is intrinsic value? I would argue that there is really no such thing as intrinsic value. Value is subjective. I would value even water, right? If I'm having a flash flood right now and everything's destroying my house and I'm going to die, right? I'm going to value water a hell of a lot less than I would value water if I were in the middle of the desert dying from dehydration and I saw a cup of water somewhere. Yep. All right. So even with water itself, value is actually very subjective, and this applies with everything. Human beings choose to assign value to things depending on how much their life benefits from it. And so additionally, this concern is also related with the idea of Bitcoin isn't physical, therefore it doesn't have value. They're very commingled. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that Bitcoin is not physical is an advantage. Okay, it's an advantage. It's an advantage that I can send something that I value to another person halfway across the globe for $1. I can send millions of dollars of this Bitcoin thing to somebody halfway across the earth in a matter of minutes. And I can't do that if this form of money is physical. Okay. Now, additionally, 2 + 2 = 4 is valuable. Okay. That is an idea in our head. That is not a physical concept, but that is obviously valuable. And so does 2 + 2 = 4 have intrinsic value? Yes. So is it possible for things in the non-physical world, in the digital world, to have value? Absolutely it is. Absolutely it is. And if you talk to millennials, who, by the way, are set to inherit, according to Coldwell Banker, Bank of America, other surveys as well, millennials are set to inherit anywhere between $60 trillion to $90 trillion over the next decade from the baby boomer generation. And millennials have no problem seeing value in the digital world. Baby boomers do, and they may never see the value in Bitcoin. But the reality is that, you know, life is cyclical, and the millennial generation is going to inherit a lot of money in about a decade. And so I believe a lot of that will be going into Bitcoin.
Yep. I completely agree. I guess maybe let's skip. I've got a couple others here that I still want to come back to, but I think it ties in a little bit to the Bitcoin isn't backed by anything. And to me, this is a relatively easy one because the dollar isn't backed by anything. You use that, it works. And what Bitcoin is, I mean, it is backed by something. It's backed by energy. It's backed by a network of people, of users. I mean, it depends on what you mean it's not backed by something. And I think the people who tend to ask that question tend to know a little bit more about monetary history, and they think of like the gold standard or something like that. But for a long time, you know, I'll let you sort of comment on this, but for a long time, gold, I mean, it was used as commodity money and it wasn't backed by anything. It was just gold, and its use in jewelry or electronics were completely irrelevant to its monetary properties. That now people assigned value to gold because of those things, but they didn't exchange gold as a form of money because of those things. It was sort of an ancillary benefit of gold. So it's not backed by anything. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, that's another common one. Gold, exactly. Gold is not backed by anything. Gold is the thing. Okay. And why is gold the thing? Well, and why do people use it in jewelry? And why is it such a revered physical object? Gold is one of the most scarce precious metals in existence. And it's also pretty recognizable as well. And so the annual production rate of gold is about 1% per year. And so the fact that gold is so scarce made it a very good form of money. Made it a very good form of money because people could save in it. People could recognize it easily. You can test if something is fool's gold or real gold. which also Bitcoin shares that quality. Bitcoin is you can verify that it's real. And so that is why you know, national currencies were backed by gold for such a long time, because it ensured that the government wouldn't be able to just print money endlessly, because it had to be backed by gold. And if it wasn't backed by gold, then the money that they're printing endlessly would lose a bunch of its value. And that's bad for national sovereignty. So thinking in terms of that, Bitcoin is more scarce than gold. There are only 21 million Bitcoin that will ever exist. And so never before in human history have we had a form of money, even with gold, that is absolutely finite and verifiably finite. And so this is what Bitcoin is. And additionally, you know, I value money, again, subjectively. Money is it's a really interesting concept, because money is pretty much something everybody agrees has value. And most of us don't even know why we agree on it, but everyone just collectively agrees this is valuable. And so when you have something like Bitcoin, which growing numbers of people are saying, I believe this is valuable. As Satoshi Nakamoto said, it's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way. And so, and aside from that, it's an extremely secure network. Like I said, it's, you know, the hashing algorithm was released published by the NSA in 2001. All these organizations use that too. And Bitcoin is also the most peer-reviewed computer code ever. So that alone is valuable. The fact that it's the most peer-reviewed computer code in all of history, and it's still going. There's still a block produced every 10 minutes.
Yeah, it's an incredible tool. And the further you dive in and you begin to understand just even like a little bit, again, like I'm not a cryptography expert, but I began to understand the difficulty adjustment and proof of work and the importance of some of these technologies. And you don't really have to understand deeply any of it to understand how incredibly robust and elegant it is simultaneously. This episode of the Bitcoin Way podcast is sponsored by us, your friends at the Bitcoin Way. If you rely on a third-party or closed-source hardware wallet for your Bitcoin custody, you are compromising on how you store your wealth. The Bitcoin Way offers white-glove service to help you take full self-custody of your Bitcoin and sleep in peace knowing you've done it right. Like most Bitcoiners, we believe that your Bitcoin stack will one day be worth a lot more than it is today. Go to thebitcoinway.com to sign up for a free consultation with a member of our team. Don't delay on protecting your wealth and reach out today. Okay. Hey, so let's do a few rapid fire here. I just want to make sure we're good on time. I know there are a few that we'll probably dig into a little deeper, but Bitcoin doesn't produce any cash flow yields. There's no dividend. How would you address that FUD or that concern of, again, usually financial advisors or those type of individuals?
Yep. So, first of all, neither does gold either. And gold has been the most highly valued form of money in the last 6,000 to 7,000 years.
True, but the Keynesians don't like gold. So how about a Keynesian financial advisor? How would you address this? Because they get their dividend stocks and that sort of thing. What are your thoughts?
Well, I guess this is more of an informal response, but you invest in the S&P 500 and I'll invest in Bitcoin over the next 10 years and we'll see who's right. Who's right in the sense of, you know, whose net worth is higher investing the same amount of money in 10 years from now? Because 10 years ago, Bitcoin would have been a significantly better investment. That said, I mean, you should still run a business. You should still be a part of business. We still need to operate in the world and have revenue generating activities. So I have no issue with somebody investing in a cash flow generating vehicle. But in terms of investment potential, it's pretty clear that Bitcoin it's almost like investing in the internet in the late 90s. It has a long way to go. It has a lot more potential compared to other already established businesses.
Yeah, I think this one's never made a whole lot of sense to me, because the way I look at it is, if you look over any 4-year period of time in Bitcoin's history, I mean, at the end of that 4-year period, Bitcoin its purchasing power is so much higher than when you began. You're ahead of the game. So if you look over a long enough time horizon and you say you've got, you know, I've got $100,000 and you've got $100,000 to put into Bitcoin, or you know, a traditional 60/40 portfolio or something that earns yield and there are dividends or some sort of cash flow, you know, that $100,000 invested in Bitcoin might be worth $1 million, you know, in a few years when we check back in. And, you know, there are a lot of reasons that we have optimism and confidence that that's likely, but we'll get into that in future episodes. But you might have, you know, 100,000, you know, or 110 or $120,000 from investing in the 60/40 or a, you know, an equity heavy portfolio or something like that. It's like, why are you so, like, why do you see it as success that you, like, you underperformed beyond anyone's wildest imagination, but you're happy because it was in the form of dividends or some sort of yield? Like, it's just, you know, it doesn't make any sense. I think the goal is to increase purchasing power, not to, overthink how it was that you achieved that purchasing power, that increase in purchasing power.
So yeah,
that's
agree.
One that's never, yeah, that's one that's never really made a whole lot of sense to me. I think it's just because it's a mindset that, well, what if it doesn't continue to increase at 124% annual compound growth rate like it has for the last decade? It's like, well, okay, cut it in half. Be conservative. What if it only compounds at, you know, 50% or 70% annually? That's going to outperform your 10% in the S&P 500.
Absolutely.
And you're going to be glad that's where you stuck your value.
Yep.
Again, let's do this one even quicker. We don't know who created Bitcoin. There's uncertainty because we don't know who the creator was.
I don't know who invented the refrigerator or who invented a lot of technologies I use today, but they were, and they make my life better, and I use them. But getting more granular, Bitcoin is it's what's called free and open source software. And so if it was a matter of how Bitcoin works, if that was a closed system where we had to trust that system, that there wouldn't be any nefarious intentions happening or any any way that it could get exploited, then that would be a problem. But the system itself is able to be verified by anyone all over the world. You can run the Bitcoin software yourself. And actually, there's a website. What is this website called? I believe it's called, here we go, bitnodes.io. And so if you go on bitnodes.io, there is a map, a worldwide map showing 18,491 nodes right now. And what is a node? A node is effectively a small, you know, like a computer, or you can buy on the internet. For example, I have a Raspberry Pi here. That's a node, but it's basically with your computer, you can audit the Bitcoin software and verify transactions, verify that there are only 21 million that can ever exist, verify how this thing actually works. So it's pretty ironic, because nobody knows who invented Bitcoin, but everybody can verify that Bitcoin works and can verify that there are no huge issues in the code itself. And I think it's a good thing that we don't know who Satoshi Nakamoto is. I think it's a good thing, because I don't want money itself having a representative. Gold doesn't have, a gold CEO or, you know, the creator of gold. I mean, who created gold? God, right? So, I mean, I don't see God here, right? But, it's a good thing if you want something to be decentralized and not have a central authority figure, that you don't know who created this. We just know that it works. And so this is also a huge difference between Bitcoin and all these other cryptos, is that pretty much all these other cryptos have founding teams, and they're basically like companies. And that's entirely different from Bitcoin. And last thing I'll mention with that, if the concern is, you know, we don't know who made Bitcoin, and therefore that uncertainty concerns me. If you just look at the notable investors in Bitcoin, I don't think a lot of people understand how impressive this list is. So I have a document. I'll read off some names that everybody listening would recognize of notable investors into Bitcoin. So there's Tim Cook, who's the CEO of Apple. He owns Bitcoin. Okay. Elon Musk, of course, owns Bitcoin. Jack Dorsey, former CEO and co-founder of Twitter. Reid Hoffman, who's co-founder of LinkedIn. What else do we have here? Steve, one of my personal favorites, Steve Wozniak, who is the co-founder of Apple. What else? Peter Thiel, co-founder of PayPal. John Mack, former CEO of Morgan Stanley. Eric Schmidt, former CEO of Doodle. David Marcus, former president of PayPal. So the list goes on and on and on and on. There are a lot of people with higher net worths than me who have been successful in their lives that believe Bitcoin has a future and invested in it.
Yeah, no, I think that's very well said. So this is probably the biggest, I hear this one a lot, especially in the United States. Government can just ban Bitcoin. Let's set aside the obvious, or what I believe to be an obvious fact, that the odds of any sort of a global ban, like China, Russia, the United States, European Union, all collaborating on a ban, pretty unlikely. We don't like each other enough. So let's set that aside and assume people are more concerned about, well, my country, let's say the United States, is going to ban Bitcoin. How do you respond to something like that?
Well, I would say, you know, probably have a, what happened when we banned drugs? You know, it's a good thing we did that because nobody uses drugs anymore, right? So I don't want people to use drugs, for the record. But just because you write a law and you say, this is banned, doesn't mean that it's going to stop. I don't want to be a criminal either. That being said, I don't want to be some kind of criminal who's breaking the law all the time or anything like that. So it would not be fun if the government banned Bitcoin. I don't think they – I'll talk on behalf of the U.S. government right now. I think they're past the point of doing that. I think they have more incentives to just embrace it than to ban it. And you look at politicians – there are a lot of pro-Bitcoin politicians. I can read some off here too. So Francis Suarez, former mayor of Miami – a lot of U.S. congressmen, Cynthia Loomis, senator of Wyoming. Ted Cruz is extremely pro-Bitcoin, senator of Texas. Michael Waltz, U.S. congressman. Michael McCall, Barry Moore, U.S. congressman. Mary Newman. I'm not going to read all the U.S. congressmen that are pro-Bitcoin, but it's pretty compelling.
Yeah. I think it becomes a lot harder to do something like that when you're not just, I mean, even if it's a minority, to tell your fellow congressman or woman, we are making illegal this asset that you have and support. It's, you know, these politicians are all friendlier with one another than they let on in the media, I think. And so I think that's difficult. It's a difficult sell to actually, you know, do that. The other thing, I mean, again, and like my theme is zoom out. If the U.S. bans Bitcoin, does it put American Bitcoin holders in an ethical dilemma? Sure. Does it diminish the value and the utility of their Bitcoin to some degree? Yeah, probably. Does Bitcoin die on a global basis? Are there still a number of use cases where Bitcoin is the best option? Yes. And so it's going to live on, and eventually you can't outrun the best money. And so, Executive Order 6102, we still have gold today. You can privately possess gold, and the demand for it was overwhelming enough that, the government couldn't monopolize that any longer. And I think the same is probably true with Bitcoin.
Yeah, I totally agree. Exactly. And yeah, you brought up a good point. I mean, if the U.S. banned it, that wouldn't stop Bitcoin itself. You're just that would be banning Americans from Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. But China is a good example. I mean, they banned Bitcoin. I lost count how many times they've tried to ban it and how many different ways. I think it's like over five at this point. But people still use Bitcoin, and China is one of the most powerful governments on earth, and they banned it. So and like I said, it's just better for people in politics to embrace this thing, and they can benefit from it too. You know, politicians, I think most Americans don't trust most politicians. That's understandable. But at the end of the day, you know, if somebody in politics wants to increase tax revenue, increase jobs, seem like they're forward thinking, no matter whatever other incentives they have, embracing Bitcoin is a good idea. And that's why you see guys like Senator Ted Cruz be pro-Bitcoin, because Texas is a huge, huge mecca of Bitcoin mining. And so a lot of jobs are created from that.
I think the incentives effectively align in such a way that Bitcoin is probably unlikely to be banned in a place like the United States. But I think the important takeaway for a lot of people is if it were, it lives on. And so, hey, I think we got another sort of our favorite mutual piece of Bitcoin FUD, and that is that mining requires too much energy or is bad for the environment. Sort of a number of angles that people take on that. Let's make this one quick, because I think it's just not important.
Yeah. Well, so you'll see headlines like Bitcoin uses more energy than the country of Denmark or Norway or whatever. And so people on the left, let's say, are concerned that, concerned about global warming and Bitcoin is boiling the oceans and climate change and all that stuff. And so here's the reality. If you believe that climate change is a threat, or if you think that climate change is a hoax, either way, Bitcoin is not consuming too much energy. So there have been reports showing that Bitcoin consumes less than, I believe it's 0.1% of global energy production. And additionally, if you think, Bitcoin miners can cause global warming, it's actually the opposite. So I'll give an example. Maybe somebody listening is familiar with oil flaring. So if you've ever driven by an oil site, you may see a flame at the top of the, I don't know what you would call that, but the, what you call it? Yeah, I'll just say oil site.
Yeah. Like the stack. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's just excess energy that these oil companies have, and they can't do anything else with it other than set it on fire. And I personally don't believe climate change is in any way a threat at all. I'm not scared by that. That's my personal opinion. But I have driven by these, the oil flares, and it probably is not good to have that. You know, I wouldn't want to breathe in that air all the time. Yeah. And so what Bitcoin miners are doing is they are able to cut off the flaring, so stop that big scary flame from happening, and redirect that energy, which otherwise would have been wasted, into Bitcoin mining. And so this is a really interesting thing, because it appeases people on the climate change side, because there have been reports showing that Bitcoin mining can reduce CO2 emissions by a factor of 30. And so that's beneficial for people on that side of the equation. It's also beneficial for people on the pro oil side of the equation too, because oil companies are able to generate an additional form of revenue. And so one example is ExxonMobil, which is, I believe, the second largest US oil and gas producer, has been mining Bitcoin for, I think it's over 3 years now. And most people don't know about that. Yeah. But they're doing the same thing. And so there are a lot of examples of how Bitcoin mining is also used by renewable energy systems, by hydroelectric power, by solar, by wind. And the way a grid works is you have to have an excess amount of energy, because you could have an event where a lot of people have to use a lot of energy at one time. And so, but that costs money, having an excess amount of energy. So if energy production sites are able to take that excess amount of energy and mine Bitcoin with it and generate additional forms of revenue, and then if there is some bad event where a bunch of people need to use a lot of energy, they can just cut the Bitcoin mining off and disperse it to the grid, then that's a very beneficial thing for everybody. It actually stabilizes energy grids.
Yeah. Effectively, Bitcoin mining can justify more energy production than would otherwise be necessary in the normal course of business, and can therefore handle those spikes in demand. Because Bitcoin miners can flip off quickly. And you're right. It seems that Bitcoin mining seeks out the most cost effective forms of energy. So if there's hydroelectric, if you don't have to negotiate rates with, you know, a public utility or something like that, and you can find hydroelectric or solar or other options like that, it's advantageous if you can do it cost effectively enough. A lot of other directions we could take that one, but I think we'll hold off on that. This is one that you've written about in Bitcoin Magazine. Bitcoin would, again, let's just touch on this, but it would, you know, Bitcoin would go down because of an EMP, the apocalypse, whatever. My argument is that I think Bitcoin going down in an event of that scale is probably the least of our concerns, especially since I don't suspect that the fiat system would continue operating very effectively under those circumstances. But let's hear some of your thoughts.
Yeah, that I would start off with that too is, you know, if there, I'm a big fan of having a quote healthy paranoia, you know, always be prepared. You never know what should happen in life, right? And so hope for the best, plan for the worst kind of mentality is good. So that said, you know, if there was some horrible situation where we lost internet and lost electricity, there would be a lot of other systems to worry about. Your bank, like you mentioned, you know, if there's some sort of apocalyptic scenario or some kind of catastrophe, you're going to be worried about water, food, a safe environment, medical supplies, things you can trade with physically. And so I think you should absolutely have physical cash on you. I think you should have a go bag with commodities that you could maybe trade with. Even if you don't smoke, you should buy a carton of cigarettes, because cigarettes are extremely valuable if something bad happens. Anyways, kind of beside the point, but you should be prepared for bad things. Now the question aside from that is also, would, if the internet and power went out, would that kill Bitcoin? And the answer is no, it would not kill Bitcoin. Even if there was some kind of horrible worldwide nuclear thing going on, there are so many nodes, which I mentioned earlier. You can find the amount of nodes on bitnodes.io. But there are so many nodes all over the world, 18,400 right now is what I'm looking at. And there, as long as you have one node running the Bitcoin software, auditing the network, keeping a list of, you know, all the historical transactions that happen, then Bitcoin survives. Okay, so if China and Russia get in nuclear war with America or something like that, just worst case scenario, there's going to be some person in Switzerland or Australia or whatever who's running a node somewhere, you know, in a bunker. I mean, it is so, quote, decentralized at this point. It's ridiculous. And then I guess lastly, as far as the idea of could an apocalypse kill Bitcoin, you would have to have a permanent discontinuation of energy and internet forever. everywhere on Earth. And even if all of the internet, all the electricity just randomly shut off everywhere on Earth at the same time, you could still have Bitcoin working once you got everything up and running again. It still wouldn't kill Bitcoin. So that's a pretty interesting concept, I think. And then last part, you know, I wrote this article as kind of a fun thought experiment. I understand most people would not be transacting like this, but there are other ways to send Bitcoin as well. I find this so interesting because Bitcoin is just data. And data can be sent in many other ways besides the internet. The internet is just the most efficient way to send data. So I've got examples of how you could send, quote, offline Bitcoin transactions. So there's mesh networks. There are, what else do we have? We have satellite communication as well. Mm-hmm. You can send Bitcoin through a sat phone.
Is radio on there? I think I'd heard something about populating a node, like the ledger on a node through radio. I don't know. So, yeah.
You can send it through amateur radio. Yeah. I mean, technically you need a license in order to use it, but,
in this scenario, I bet you the FCC isn't very concerned about you.
No.
Yeah.
No, but there are examples. Like there's one Bitcoiner. You can find his Twitter, just type in NVK. And he did an example of where he sent a Bitcoin transaction through amateur radio. It's pretty cool. And then, so I would say my personal favorite, which is the most James Bond style, is it's called Sneakernet. It's facetiously called Sneakernet because you could print out a Bitcoin transaction on a piece of paper and walk or drive like 20 miles or something like that, and then scan it, and then you'd have the Bitcoin in your wallet. So there are just so many ways to send data itself.
Right. Yeah. I think this is, that's a good, reading your article was, I'd encourage everyone to go, I don't know, probably, you know, just look up Bitcoin Magazine, Andrew Howard and Apocalypse, and you'll find it. So, hey, are you good on time? We're almost at an hour here, about an hour. Are you okay to answer? I think we've got maybe three more that we talked about discussing. Are you good?
Let's go. Yep.
Okay. Securing Bitcoin is too hard.
It's scary for sure. I don't think it's hard. I'll give you guys a recommendation right now. It's a big change to go from trusting a bank, trusting a financial institution with your money to keep your money safe, to go from that to being the only person that keeps your money safe, mm-hmm. and having a lot of responsibility there. There's a lot of freedom there, right? Because you never know what should happen with any financial institution eventually, right? I mean, you've had bank seizures in the past in countries like Lebanon and Venezuela. And, you know, I mean, you never know what should happen. And you should own your own money. But there's a lot of responsibility. So I would recommend for anybody that really wants to get a second set of eyes, giving some advice on Bitcoin security and storing Bitcoin, I would say talk to the Bitcoin Way. Talk to a Bitcoin consultant. Talk to people who have been doing this for years who can just give you a sanity check. But it's pretty easy, you know? I mean, if you in practice, really all it is just making sure that nobody else has 12 words of yours or 24 words of yours, and maybe a passphrase on there too, if you want. So what, 13 or 25 words? That's in theory, it's pretty easy. There are also options like multi-sig where you can go to companies. I believe you guys offer some kind of multi-sig setup too. Is that the case?
Yeah. So if you've got Bitcoin self-custody concerns or you want a set of eyes on the way you're going about it, we can help with single sig, multi-sig. Effectively, what we're going to do is just help you get set up the right way. I mean, the Bitcoin way, that's, you know, that's the name of the game. So
yeah,
there are plenty of hardware devices, nodes you can run. Some are better than others. You know, we lean toward open source and ultimately helping you take custody and not rely on a trusted third party.
Yep, exactly. Yep.
So yeah, I think that's a great answer, and thank you for the plug. So this one generates more memes when it's brought up, and that is Bitcoin can be divided, so it's not really scarce, or can be infinitely divided, so it's not really scarce. I want to hear your thoughts. I know probably what analogy you'll give, and I think I have one too that I could maybe share.
Yeah, I've never heard this from anybody in the real world. I've only seen this like form of FUD from like fancy economists who think they're super smart. But like Francis Coppola, or however you say your name. I mean, that it's just such a ridiculous thing. If I have one pizza and I can, it's almost like such a ridiculous concern that I don't even want to. You can't. Bitcoin has a maximum of 21 million that can never be produced. So it is absolutely finite, and you can divide it into smaller units, but that doesn't mean that it's any more or any less finite. It's like a dollar, you know, a dollar can be broken up into 100 cents, but that doesn't mean that the $1 is less scarce. Maybe that was a bad example because dollars aren't scarce, but I think you get the point.
No, but the way I look at it is if you want to buy something, if you want to buy a car for $20,000, if you break those 20,000 $1 bills up into pennies, can you buy a more expensive car now? No, of course not. Or if the government suddenly came in and said, we're going, because another thing is people say, well, the code could be, you know, changed. It could be a fork to allow instead of 100 million Satoshis per Bitcoin, it's, you know, a billion. It like, you know, you could break it up into smaller parts. It's like, okay, well, if the federal government came along and said, we're going to create something called micro pennies, and it's a thousandth of a penny. Well, if you break your $20,000 purchase into micro pennies now, can you buy more car? And the answer is, of course not. You still have a finite number of a finite amount of value that you're trying to transact with. So yeah, I think that's
a good example. Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of a funny one. I understand. It's like one of those ones that if you don't stop and think about it, I can see how it would trip you up. But if you stop and think about it for like 30 seconds, you could probably need to move on and come up with something a little more compelling to attack Bitcoin with. Bitcoin is a bubble Ponzi scheme, scam, tulip bulb mania. Well, pick your scam.
I think we went over that one a lot.
We touched on that several times, I think.
Yeah, I mean, Bitcoin is a scam. Like, I think I would go back to talking about the other notable investors that have produced a ton of valuable things for a lot of people in the world that believe Bitcoin is a helpful, beneficial, revolutionary, big deal technology. You know, again, CEO of Apple, co-founder of LinkedIn, co-founder of Apple, former CEO of Doodle, co-founder of PayPal. All these people own Bitcoin and have positive things to say about it. And are they investing in a scam? I don't think so. So
I'd also add that a scam is perpetrated by an individual or a group of people. And so it's like, okay, can you point to the scammer? Are they in the room with you? It's like, who's the scammer of Bitcoin? It's no one owns it. There's no CEO. There's no foundation or organization behind it. It's a bunch of people who have identified value in a scarce monetary technology that is decentralized and globally dispersed. And, you know, and you look at when you compare it to like the tulip bulb thing too, like the tulip bulb thing was ultimately 6 months, and it was absolute insanity, and it made no sense, and you weren't investing in a scarce asset or something with long-term durability. And so the analogies just break down so quickly.
Yeah.
If you really want to do an intellectually honest apples to apples comparison, there really isn't one. And I think a lot of people just, I think a lot of people have heard that from some, you know, from Jamie Dimon or someone on the news or a friend, you know, who shouldn't have sold their Bitcoin, you know, at the bottom, and they're bitter.
There's a lot of that too. Yeah. People who sell it and then regret it, and now they just hate it, and it's like an ego thing. And Yeah. Just one last point on that is there are a ton of scams, and I think everything other than Bitcoin is a scam as far as crypto. They are legitimate scams, and there's so much confusion around this. Like even FTX, when FTX collapsed, some people thought that's because Bitcoin was a scam, and they're just entirely different. That's like saying, I don't know, it's almost like saying this banking institution collapsed, therefore gold's a scam. It's literally like the same kind of accusation. It's totally unrelated. FTX was a company. They had their own cryptocurrency that they made, which was an actual scam. And so I think Bitcoin is the only investable crypto asset. It's the only one where we know we don't have some kind of founding team trying to sell it to people and make money off of it. The creator of Bitcoin, Satoshi Nakamoto, fictitious name, obviously, but he still has not moved his coins. He has not sold anything since it was created. And I think he's like the top 25 richest men in the world now, or whoever he, she, they are. Just the fact about that, I mean, if it was some kind of Ponzi scheme, you want to have people at the top, they try and sell out and dump on their investors. And that's what you see with these cryptocurrencies. It's just the complete opposite with Bitcoin. So,
yeah, completely agree. Yeah. Last one for you. Bitcoin is like MySpace and will be overtaken by a better competitor. And you sort of did a little bit of a competitor analysis there. But aside from the fact, you know, I'm with you. I think most other cryptocurrencies are scams. And the distinction I would draw between a scam and a not scam is intent. I think some people probably, you know, went in with the intention to do something, to provide utility, do something good. Was it necessary? No, we don't need more than Bitcoin. Absolutely not. But, you know, I guess why couldn't, in your mind, something else catch up and become what we believe Bitcoin is going to be in the future?
Yeah, so that I think this is probably one of the most reasonable points of concern is that, well, couldn't a better cryptocurrency just come out and then replace Bitcoin? It makes sense. So here's how I would answer that. And the networks of the internet are not the same thing as Bitcoin. So from a technical perspective, you know, this is not the same exact kind of comparison, but it's a good comparison to make. TCP/IP, which stands for Transmission Control Protocol / Internet Protocol, is the dominant network of the internet that everyone communicates on. It's what you and I are communicating on right now. And TCP/IP was created in the 1970s. And so that is a very old technology, right? So, but what happened is, you know, you had competing networks of the internet, and TCP/IP remained to be the dominant one. And so why is that? Because it developed what's called a network effect, which is when so many people are using the same network and they can't communicate with each other outside of that network. You know, if I'm using one network and you're using another, I can't communicate with you because you have to be on my network or I have to be on yours. So many people were using TCP/IP that it made more sense to build new stuff on top of it instead of, oh, there's this other network and it has a bunch of other better advanced technological functions and we're all going to move to that network. It's just much more practical to have more advanced technologies built on one network everybody's using instead of to try and convince them to switch to this other quote better network. So in real terms, some examples are, you know, there are different layers that are built on top of TCP/IP. Different applications too, like HTML, HTTPS, SMPP or something like that. It's the email. Anyways, there all of this is built on top of TCP/IP. And so really the same thing is happening with Bitcoin right now. I believe his name is Paul Buchheit, who's the creator of Gmail, has this quote. He said, I believe Bitcoin is the TCP/IP of money. And so the idea is that Bitcoin itself is the base layer of this new digital, online, decentralized financial system that is currently being created. And you have other layers being built on top of Bitcoin right now. So one example is the Lightning Network, which is where you can send Bitcoin for quicker and cheaper than the base layer Bitcoin network. So anyways, that's how I'd answer the question there. And then plus, yeah, actually, just one last point on that,
yeah,
is, and I got to go in 10 minutes, actually, I have a call. There are tens of thousands of other cryptocurrencies that exist right now. And they still haven't replaced Bitcoin. Bitcoin mm-hmm. still has the most amount of usage and the highest market cap. And so by all metrics available, Bitcoin still has the dominant network effect, no matter how many new cryptocurrencies are created.
Right. Completely agree. I'd add two comments to that. One is I saw on Twitter a while back, someone said, what's stopping, you know, someone from copying Bitcoin's code and, you know, making one minor adjustment that makes it slightly better and saying, you know, okay, here's now better Bitcoin. And he said, hey, here's my new internet I created, come join it. And it's like, that's it. It's like, it's the network effect. Good luck getting the lift and the friction to get people to switch onto a new tool when there's already one that's working and solving problems is enormous. And the second thing, I think it was in Inventing Bitcoin by Jan Pritzker, he talks about this and he said, the difference between the MySpace Facebook comparison that people like to draw is when you can have a MySpace and a Facebook account, but if you have a dollar to purchase Bitcoin or Ethereum or any number of other cryptocurrencies, when you put that dollar in, you don't have that dollar anymore to vote for something else effectively. And if you look at, we're 15 years into this now, and in spite of 20,000 or whatever, I think you're right, it's somewhere in that ballpark, 20,000 other cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin's dominance is at over 52% or something ridiculous of the market. There's just no catching up. It's the fundamentals are still intact. The downtime is never, you know, it's I understand why people they view Bitcoin because they don't really understand it as like a tech company. And is it really going to be the tech company that lives on? Is it going to be the Google? Is it going to be the Facebook? Or is it going to be the Yahoo or the MySpace? And the answer is it's not any of those. It's its own beast. It's its own thing. And everyone who puts a dollar into it is voting on Bitcoin and its dominance has continued. So that's sort of the way I like to think of it, at least since reading Inventing Bitcoin. By the way, anyone, if you are looking for a good, awesome intro book on Bitcoin to understand how it really works in a little bit more detail without getting too technical, I would strongly recommend Inventing Bitcoin. Andrew, anything that we didn't touch on or any other comments you have?
I think we conquered a lot in this conversation. Yeah,
man, so, I hope so.
If somebody's still worried about Bitcoin after this, then I don't know. There's no hope.
Yeah.
Yeah. But no, actually, no. I thought about something. If somebody is still concerned, I understand. You should be skeptical. And you should verify and learn on your own instead of trusting us. But, I think we gave good reasons, but, there's a really great website called endthefud.org. Let me verify. Have you ever been on this website?
I think I've seen it. Haven't okay. looked at it in a while. Yeah.
Yeah. It's .org. endthefud.org. And so okay. it's just a long list of all these resources debunking these concerns that we talked about. So for anybody who wants to really deep dive and have these concerns addressed, I would highly recommend this website.
Terrific. That's great. Andrew, I think you crushed it, man. That was exactly what I was hoping for. I really hope this is like a, you know, a brief enough episode that if you're a Bitcoiner and you've got family or friends looking for answers or haven't, you know, who have these questions, concerns, that this is a resource that could be helpful for them. So thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on. Nice speaking with you, Michael. It's fun.
Nice talking to you, Andrew. Take care.
Peace.
Alrighty, that's a wrap. Hope you enjoyed that conversation. I know I sure did. Andrew, again, is just a wealth of knowledge. He talks with people all day long about Bitcoin, so makes a lot of sense that he would be very articulate in addressing and opposing some of the common Bitcoin FUD. But again, I think it's one of those topics that we just need to get better and better at as Bitcoiners and to be able to have, you know, ready-made content to share with friends and family as they ask these questions. As always, you can drop me a line. I'm on Twitter, X, whatever we're calling it, @TheOtherMJordan. And check us out. Follow us on Twitter at The Bitcoin Way. It's @TheBitcoinWay_. And we'll see you there. This is Michael Jordan signing off. Until next time.